This morning, I want to talk about disillusionment. It's a profound description of Oscar Schindler's complete disillusionment at the particular moment. That's why I had that brutal reading read. Anyway, disillusionment is a common experience the world over. Many religious liberals are disillusioned with growing political ascendancy and all the triumph of the religious right. Environmentalists are disillusioned with discarded pollution controls. Indigenous rights and labor activists disillusioned with economic globalization. And of course, peace activists the world over are disillusioned about American foreign policy now that it's firmly in the hands of demagogue-loving Donald Trump and his no-kid-gloves imperial foreign policy. William Bridges was an American author, speaker, and organizational consultant who wrote wisely about disillusionment in his best-selling book, Transitions. He died about 4 years ago. Bridges studied how people deal with difficult passages in their lives, especially those who negotiate them creatively and with grace and renewed vitality, who manage to land on their feet and seem to have a knack for it or have achieved a capacity to land on their feet regularly in the midst of these difficult transitions. Having taken disillusionment apart, Bridges proposed that instead of one term, disillusionment, there be three: disenchantment, often a good thing; disengagement is a natural response to disenchantment, and it's also a good thing; and then third, re-engagement, which is also healthy and natural, but can sometimes get short-circuited in despair or disparagement, both of which always are sad and sometimes even wicked, you could say, when you just get stuck. I'll go into that. So what I'm preaching on ultimately is how to avoid despair, how to avoid disparagement. Not how to avoid disillusionment, mind you, since that can be and often is a good thing and an important thing in the growth process. No, I want to talk about recognizing disillusionment as potentially destructive, but also potentially very positive and creative. Let us contemplate then disillusionment as a three-part process: disenchantment, disengagement, and re-engagement. This process is common to all life transitions, moves, illnesses, deaths, job changes, divorces, any of the many changes that we all go through, sometimes willingly and sometimes not so willingly in our lives. Now, it seems to me that there's probably no time in a person's life more transitional than the teenage years. These are tough times. If you have forgotten, you're probably lucky. But kids, really, it's tough. And I think it's much tougher now than it seemed safer when I was a kid. I don't know, but it seemed a lot safer. But teenage years are tough for everyone. Those of our young people who get lost in the despair of drugs, gangs, rigid political, religious fringe movements, and suicide have basically become hung up halfway through the creative disillusionment process. They've let go of their old identity or their old situation as children, but they haven't been able to make the transition to the new as young adults. Our ESUC coming-of-age program, which we run every couple of years, so we're not actually running it this year, we're going to have our whole lives,
which is a sex education program. And then the next year, we'll have the coming of age program. But it's designed to help our kids make that transition. Still, we all know that adolescence is an up for grabs kind of experience, and that it can be pretty tough. There is always a danger for any of us whenever we're in the midst of a major transition, let alone two or three. Separated from an old identity and former situation in life, we float, kind of free float, between two worlds. But there are many ways, most ways probably, in which we are still tied to the old world more than the new one we're moving toward. There's still a reality in our heads, in our minds, a picture of how things ought to be, or the way things indeed are, which ties us to our old world and identity with subtle strands of assumption and expectation. The sun will rise tomorrow, we assure ourselves. My parents have always loved me and put me first. The government would never lie to us. God is just. These things are so, we believe. And if they are not, suddenly our world is no longer real. The realization that in certain respects one's world is indeed no longer real is what I mean when I speak of disenchantment. To see, oh, it's not that way. Even though I always thought that, even though I'm operating on these assumptions, but no, it's not. That's disenchantment. In traditional rites of passage, disenchantment was a very carefully arranged and orchestrated experience. And it was the most critical revelation of adulthood training. In the ceremony for entry into the healing cult of the Ndembu in Zambia, initiates are brought before a strange shape in the jungle, which they're told is Kabula, the cult's spirit. Then suddenly and unexpectedly, they're told to beat the spirit shape with sticks and kill it. In the end, they're shown that the thing being beaten is nothing but a cloth-covered frame under which adepts had been hiding. A similar process takes place in other rites of passage ceremonies. The Hopi youth, these are little Kachina dolls, you might have seen one, but they're replicas in miniature of these huge life-size, they're kind of like puppets, they're huge masks that the Hopi elders wear. And when they see the youths that going through their mantra training, see the Kachinas unmasked for the first time, revealing their neighbors and uncles and friends, they're completely disillusioned. Or when terrified initiates in Aboriginal Australia are shown that the fearful sound of the great spirit, Duramula, is nothing more than a bull roar, a piece of stick on a thong, in all of these and countless other sacred initiation rites, digital disillusionment is the essence of the newly revealed adult truth, the ultimate truth. It's like there are no gods. Your uncle said, we're the gods. Hello? We're the gods. Now, I'm not saying there's really no God, but the gods are a function of our own interaction with one another and our imagination and our collective spirit. It's not some other thing. Talk about liberation. Talk about open-mindedness and openness to revelation. Contrast this with how we typically prepare our youth. Fill them up with firmly held wishes, illusions, that when destroyed, all but destroy their faith in everything. For example, America is the greatest country on earth, home of the land, home of the free and the land of the brave. Then they find out about the slave trade, Watergate, CIA, profiteering in Central America and now across the globe. Or we encourage them to look up to hard-working and successful role models like Lance Armstrong and Barry Bonds, to name two recent examples, who turn out to be all too unheroic. The Hopi and the Ndembu and the Australian Aborigines may, I suspect, have long understood something that we in our literate sophistication have forgotten, that disillusionment is a natural and regular way of life. Think of the hundreds of disenchantments in our own lives, discoveries about Santa Claus, discoveries that parents sometimes lie and are afraid and make immature decisions, that best friends can let you down terribly. These disenchantments did not end with our childhoods either, nor are they over yet. One's lifetime is a long chain of disenchantments, many small and a few huge. Lovers who prove unfaithful, leaders who are corrupt, idols who have turned out to be petty and dull, organizations that have betrayed our trust. And worst of all, those times when we ourselves turn out to be what we said or even believed we were not. Disenchantment, one eventually discovers, is a recurrent experience throughout the lifetime of anyone who has the courage and truth to believe in the first place. Now, in every life transition, certainly in every disillusioning transition, disenchantment, it seems to me, is the first step. And often it's the only very slowly and in retrospect that we begin to see disenchantment as meaningful in any positive way. When you discover that fatal love letter, or get the news that you've been fired, you know, both of which, Emerson says, the minister should reveal him or herself a little bit, you know, both of which I've had happen to me, and it's very disillusioning. But when it happens, right then, it's pointless to talk about old realities or new ones. Later, however, it is important to reflect on these things. The old must be cleared away before the new can grow. There's a famous story from Japan about a university professor, probably half of you have heard this, but I'll repeat it, who went to visit a famous Zen master in order to learn from him. And during their meeting, the professor talked on and on about all the books he'd read on Zen and the various Zen masters he had spoken to. And meanwhile, the master prepared tea for his guest. And when it was ready, he poured some into the visitor's cup with perfect form. He filled it to the brim and then kept pouring as the tea splashed across the table and onto the floor. The professor watched in horror until he could stand it no longer and finally blurted out, "It's over full. No more will go in." "You are just like this cup," the master serenely replied, "so full of your own ideas and opinions that there is no room for anything new. How can I teach you about Zen unless you first empty your cup?" Jesus similarly pointed this out in Matthew 9:17, explaining that the mind is a vessel that must be emptied of old wine before new wine can be filled. Lacking such a perspective, we often miss the growth opportunity disillusioning experiences provide. The disenchanted person recognizes the old view as sufficient in its time, but insufficient now. I needed to believe that husbands or friends or mentors were always trustworthy. It protected me against some of the contingencies of life. On the other hand, the despairing person simply rejects the embodiment of the earlier view, not the view. She gets a new husband or he gets a new boss, but both of them leave unchanged the old enchanted view of relationships. The disenchanted move on, but the despairing gets stuck. They buy tickets to the same play, watch it all over again, only this time with new actors. Try thinking about this as a Hindu would. You might be stuck for untold lifetimes, but eventually you can always come around. Take, for instance, the Bill Murray character in that movie, Groundhog Day. He kept going through the same routine again and again day after day until he finally woke up and left his old enchantment behind, as any of us can do too. The despairing are stuck all right, but the good news is that it may be only temporary, only, I don't know, 10, 15 lifetimes. The really stuck, on the other hand, the very saddest souls, it seems to me, are the people who dispense with enchantment altogether, old or new. Having been burned a couple of times, they deal with their wounds by freezing up and turning themselves into hardened, no-nonsense cynics. Their worlds have little wonder or redemptive good fortune at all. All men are misogynists, they maintain. Politicians are all corrupt. Germans are closet Nazis, every one of them. Asians are thieves. We've heard these types of pronouncements. "My God died," wrote the Nobel-winning author Elie Wiesel, "when I got off the train at Auschwitz." As it did for most people who disembarked that train. But while many became cynics, Wiesel did not. He writes about it in, well, he wrote over 30 books. He wrote about it specifically in Night, an autobiographical account of his experiences in the death camps. Saddest of all, he says, were the Musulmans, as they were known in the camps, veritable zombies the Walking Dead, basically. Wiesel refused to become a Musulman. He moved on. Disenchanted, yes. Disengaged, surely. Uncomprehending, without a doubt. Blown away by the inhumanely brutal events that threatened to topple his faith. Yes, all of that. The God of Wiesel's youth died. That's for sure. As emphatically as the Ndebele's Kaluva dies when it's revealed to be nothing but a cloth-covered frame. But Elie Wiesel did not respond to his disillusionment by just quitting. He disengaged all right, but then he re-engaged from a new grown-up perspective. He continued his dialogue, his struggle with God. Still, he continued to wrestle with life. He still questioned. He demanded to know what could make all this happen. How is it construed, put together? What's the framework? He never quit trying to understand. He never quit wrestling with God, like Jacob. Another death camp survivor was the Viennese psychotherapist Viktor Frankl, author of The Opening Words. Frankl's observations complement Wiesel's, it seems to me, especially about the redemptive value of refusing to quit wrestling with God, reality, fate, whatever you want to call it, and refusing to be a Muslim. "Everything can be taken from a man," wrote Frankl, "but the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude to any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." No doubt many of you saw have seen the 1993 Steven Spielberg movie, Schindler's List. Oscar Schindler is a very good example of what I mean by creative disillusionment. At the movie's beginning, our as-yet-undiscovered hero is totally wrapped up in Nazism, proud to be a party member and gladly exploiting the opportunities that it affords him to meet women and make money. But as time goes on, and as he begins to really see the Nazis for what they were, he became disenchanted. In the movie, as in the book, Schindler's disenchantment is symbolized by his growing horror watching the movements of a little red-coated girl amidst the SS murderers liquidating the ghetto of Krakow. But his disenchantment led neither to disengagement nor despair. He goes from disenchantment to disengagement. Then, once he sees more clearly, he changes his view and his approach. He stops abetting the Nazi machine and begins subverting it. He becomes re-engaged, fighting fearlessly to confront the Nazi system, and he was remarkably successful, very skillful, Oskar Schindler, though, is one of many. Elie Wiesel, Viktor Frankl, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Cory Aquino, Nelson Mandela, the list goes on. All these heroes suffered grave disenchantment, but avoided despair by this and then re-engaging. All life is change, transition. Asked once what was the greatest wisdom he knew, Abraham Lincoln replied that this too will pass. Life is change, is transition. If you want to be alive, you've got to change too, along with it. Above all, you simply can't allow yourself to stagnate, which is essentially what happens to cynics. They give up, like Muslims, quit growing, and spiritually they die. We are, I think, all of us in some fundamental archetypal way like Jacob, the biblical patriarch. Before he started to struggle with the deeper questions of life, symbolized by his wrestling with an angel, he was just Jacob. Good old Jacob, just another untransformed, somewhat sneaky guy. But once he re-engaged, he became Israel, one who struggles with God, with life. One of the functions of traditional adolescent training and initiation rituals was to provide the now become adults with role models of appropriate behavior, that is, with heroes and heroines. Israel, Jacob, is just such a hero and a prototype, it seems to me, for all growth, all transformation, all renewal of hope and faith and meaning. The man struggles, and throughout the pages of Genesis becomes disillusioned time and again, yet each disillusionment is followed by a disengagement and then a re-engagement as he continues to struggle. He doesn't quit, he gets down. He doesn't jump off the bridge, he builds a new bridge. He doesn't gnash teeth and rend garments, well, he does a little bit, but not for long. He keeps his eyes relaxed and his ears open, holds his head high, and he goes forward, letting the old illusions go, seeing anew. And thus it all comes to him again and again and again, the beginner's mind cultivated by Zen. It would be helpful, I think, if our adolescent training rituals focused on these dynamics, giving our young people a paradigm of disillusionment into re-engagement as natives do. If we unmasked the Kachinas. Instead, we are, most of us anyway, brought up on a variety of worn-out shibboleths and cliches. My country, right or wrong, all you need is love, onward and upward, progress forever. Someday my prince will come, they'll live happily ever after. All of which are nothing but illusions. They're beautiful illusions, mind you. It's true. And truthful illusions for a time. That is, until we outgrow them and can re-engage with new, more grown-up illusions, or with the old illusions, but in new, more grown-up ways. No longer clinging to some fading or faded cloth-covered frame, but letting go with engaged, that is, re-engaged open hearts and minds. Willing to get burned and willing to grow, re-engaging in the wake of each lost illusion, in the words of Lennon and McCartney, looking through a glass onion, looking through and peeling away the layers of life, one after another, unmasking the Kachinas, letting go to have it all on our way home.